the week of August 15th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 67, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in an ashram in India finding myself, I'm Michael Giltz.
I was considering saying I was in Bali.
Well, that would be sexier.
Well, I'm sure this has something to do with the opening of Julie Roberts' Eat, Pray, Love, which we'll be talking about in a second. Michael, I'm sure you will tell us exactly how well or how poorly that film did. And we're recording a little late this week due to some travel schedules, specifically my own travel schedule. But we do have a real treat for you. Todd Martins of the Los Angeles Times will be joining us. And you might recall he joined us to explain and talk about Coachella on episode 50. This time he's stopping by to discuss the topic of music digital downloads and how they affected Arcade Fire's recent album release. And speaking of digital, we'll also be talking about Netflix and Hulu, who had some interesting news break last week. Of course, it wouldn't be Showbiz Sandbox if we didn't review all the week's top entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop, and we'll finish with a little inside baseball where we reveal a new angel which has arrived in Hollywood. And that's a little tease. You can figure out what that means.
I thought it meant Charlie's Angel.
Me too.
No.
But that shows where we're at.
Yes. Well, first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's top film gross earners at the box office. Michael, take it away.
The number one film of the weekend was The Expendables, the Sylvester Stallone extravaganza with every 80s action star you've ever heard of. It grossed $34.8 million. It's clearly going to be one of Sylvester Stallone's biggest hits, probably since his heyday in the mid-80s with the Rocky and Rambo movies. I mean, it's a huge movie. It's just exponentially bigger than anything he's done in a while. So padding it with all those other stars certainly helped. Eat, Pray, Love is at number two, the Julia Roberts film where she finds herself, which is always easy to do when you can afford to travel the globe. That grossed $23.1 million thanks to a lot of women and a best-selling memoir. Number three is The Other Guys with Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg. That grossed $17.4 million. That's at $69 million total, performing pretty well for a typical Will Ferrell movie. At number four is Inception, which grossed $11.2 million. It's at almost $250 million in the U.S. And overseas, it's grossed another $314 million. So you're looking at $565 million worldwide and counting. And at number five, the coolest movie of the week, which I saw and loved, Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which grossed $10.6 million, a fairly disappointing amount, I guess, for a movie that cost $60 to $80 million to make. And they were hoping for bigger things, but Michael Cera's not quite a breakout star yet. I loved it. I saw it. Did you guys see it?
No, I didn't. I saw Eat, Pray, Love.
And?
I didn't hate it. I hated the book. I didn't hate the movie, but it's a bad movie. It's shallow. It's boring. Thank God they had Julia Roberts, because if they hadn't, this movie would not have even been worth seeing.
Of course, there are some who would say that because it had Julia Roberts, it's not worth seeing. But that's another.
Who would say that?
I don't know. A lot of people who saw Closer would say that. They felt that she ruined Closer, the movie.
Well, I'm not saying that I think she's a good actress, because I don't think she is. But she was perfect for this role, because you really have to have somebody likable and somewhat relatable. Because if you've ever read the book, I don't know if either one of you guys did, the character is so. To my way of thinking, she was so self-involved and such a whiner and just not somebody I would be friends with. So in order to cast this, it was important to get somebody somewhat likable and relatable.
Well, some people act like she's been gone for ages, but I mean, she was part of the ensemble of Valentine's Day, which grossed $110 million earlier this year. She was in Duplicity last year, which is one of my favorite films of the year. Not a big box office hit. But Closer was, you know, in 2004, but she's been in the Ocean's movies, which aren't quite her movies, but still there she is. So, and this opening of $23 million, which is fairly in line with her heyday when she was, you know, in Erin Brockovich and Runaway Bride and Notting Hill, $20 to $30 million, you know, movie after movie after movie. So this seems to me showing her mainstay as a movie star.
Well, elsewhere on the box office list here, Despicable Me passes $220 million. That's doing quite well.
Yeah, I don't know why. It's and you know, Steve Carell's got that and Date Night, which I saw, which was awful. It was barely a movie. And Dinner for Schmucks, which is also doing okay. He's probably the biggest star in the world right now.
Step Up 3D drops 56% from its...
That's no surprise.
That's no surprise at all.
Well, it costs $30 million to make, and it's grossed $30 million so far. And by the way, overseas, it's already grossed $32 million. So it's grossing more over, you know, overseas than it has in the U.S. so far.
But
so,
that's probably why they made this movie. I mean, that's why they will continue to churn out Step Up movies.
That's
just
right.
Dancing, that is, you know, that travels well.
And the final big news of the box office was Toy Story 3, which officially passed $400 million in the U.S. and officially worldwide has grossed $940 million globally, which means it has passed Shrek 2 as the biggest animated film worldwide of all time. That's a, and, you know, if they re-release it in the fall or before Oscar, maybe it could pass even the $441 million that Shrek 2 grossed in the U.S. But that's just a huge amount and just shows Pixar's unbelievable streak isn't even close to ending.
Well, and Salt passed the $100 million mark, Angelina Jolie's action film. It passed that here in North America, and overseas it's not doing too badly. I think it's made $83.2 million so far.
Well, right, and it's just getting overseas. Going, so we'll have to see how it does overall.
Can we go back to the Expendables for a second?
Well, now this is the film that is going to save Lionsgate in a way.
Absolutely, and I think there's a wonderful irony to that. But it sort of concerns me that a movie... You know, this kind of total dude movie did so well because you know what that means, right? More dude movies.
Well, wait a second.
When have there
40% of the audience that saw Expendables this past weekend was consisted of women?
Yeah, who were there with their boyfriends and husbands. That's
all the men who were at Eat, Pray, Love were there with their wives and girlfriends. That's how movies work.
Yeah. Do you know how many men were at Eat, Pray, Love in my theater?
Zero.
Two.
They were gay.
Exactly. But studies have shown this over and over again. Men will, it's more likely that a woman will agree to go see a guy movie than a guy will go see a chick flick. He's more likely to say to his significant other, just go with your girlfriends.
Well, the big disappointment of the week was Scott Pilgrim versus the World. You saw it, Michael. And I guess after Comic-Con, everybody thought all of these fans, all the hype around that film, it certainly got some great reviews. Everybody expected it to do a little bit better than $10.6 million.
They had this movie estimated to do 12.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, Comic-Con is a joke as far as estimating box office. It just means that the fanboys won't hate it or do hate a movie. You know, it has no relationship really to worldwide buzz. It's this fake world, you know, where you can get them excited about a movie. You think, oh my God, Kick-Ass is going to make $100 million. No, you know, you got to keep in perspective who those people are. You know, as far as if it fails at Comic-Con, that's always a bad sign. But being good there just means, all right, you don't have a total disaster. And it got great reviews, as it should have. It's a fun movie, but how much do you expect a Michael Cera movie to open at? It's a great role for him, but he's been in a lot of movies lately. And it's a very quirky, funny little movie that plays a lot on video games and anime. And it's clever and smart, but I can't imagine my mother seeing it. I don't think she'd have a clue as to what's going on. And she certainly wouldn't giggle over the video game bleeps being used in the film score, you know, the way the audience that I saw it with cheered.
Right. 58% of the audience was under 25. And I guess there's some question in my own mind as to if they're under 25, are they avoiding the film because they're busy on the internet or playing video games or just generally doing other things? Is it because, let's face it, if you're under 25, it's not that easy to find employment these days. They don't have the money to go see the film. They'll wait for the DVD.
Well, the audience was for people under 25. It certainly wasn't for people over 25.
Yeah, I mean, I think it made what it should have made, and they spent too much money to make the film. I'm not quite sure. The special effects aren't that elaborate, really. I'm not quite sure why it costs $85 million to make, except that you can't walk out the door in Hollywood and make a movie for less than 60. So, you know, it should have. I would expect a movie described like this to me to make $30 to $40 million total, and that's exactly what I hope this movie will make, and it'll be a big hit on DVD because it's a cult classic in the making.
It'll do well in ancillary markets for sure.
Well, certainly the graphic novels that it's based on are a huge hit, so everybody at Lionsgate is hoping that it has some legs and will continue to perform.
You mean at Universal?
Yeah, I'm going to go with Universal since that's the studio that released it. Everybody at Universal is hoping that, you know, next week it won't drop precipitously 40 or 50%, that it might only drop 15 or 20%.
And finally, to prove how smart we are, we've been saying since Twilight Saga Eclipse opened that, hey, ignore all the confusion about the opening weekend box office compared to last time, blah, blah, blah. It'll make exactly what the last movie made, and that's exactly where it is right now. $296 million in the U.S., and New Moon made $296 million in the U.S. And last week, we were talking about Tom Cruise and how he's a big star overseas, even though maybe he's dimming a bit in the U.S., and his movie Night and Day has pretty much doubled what it made in the U.S. so far and counting. It's grossed $140 million overseas, where it grossed $75 million in the U.S.
Michael, we also talked a couple of weeks ago about a documentary. We had to cut that piece from the finished episode, but we talked about the Pat Tillman documentary, and that documentary was in the news again this week. The Weinstein Company is going to be releasing it, and they tried to appeal the rating they received. They received an R rating classification from the Motion Picture Association of America, which is kind of a big deal here in the United States because it means, you know, you can't get in if you're under 17 and you can't advertise during certain times on television or in certain newspapers at certain sizes. So they tried to appeal it. It's a documentary about Pat Tillman, the former football star, the NFL football star, who died in Afghanistan in 2004. And there was some kind of...
Well, he was killed by friendly fire.
Right.
And then the U.S. government covered that up and lied to the family repeatedly for years about how and why he died.
Yes. And it received an R rating due to language, strong language being used. Because during wartime, you never curse. There's no profane words when you're being shot at.
Golly gee, no way.
It's actually not, you know, there's no war footage to my mind in the movie. There's footage of people hanging out and some recreations of stuff. But the language used is basically the F word. This family, there's a series of jokes in the movie about how the Tillmans, their kids curse up a storm and how the parents really didn't really care and didn't make a big deal about it. And the F word is used repeatedly. His brother uses it very amusingly at his memorial service, which I remember when it aired on CNN, that the brother started saying effing this and effing that, talking about his brother. It was unbelievable. It was hilarious. And really, some of the funniest uses of the F word you'll hear all year are in this movie, from the dad, from the kids, from the brother, in very emotional, touching moments. That's the only reason this movie got an R, because of the F word. On the one hand, it's silly. A PG-13 would be perfectly appropriate for this movie. There's no explicit violence or sex. It's one word used in an emotional, important context. No kid under 18 is going to rush to the movie just to hear the F word. On the other hand, no kid under 18 is going to see the movie anyway, so it doesn't matter that it got an R rating.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, I can't see this movie appealing to kids under the age of 18.
But it's a good movie, and it's well worth seeing.
Well, another movie that got an R rating was another documentary, and they tried to appeal it and lost. And I can't remember who made the film or who was appealing it, but it was basically an unfinished film about the Nazi occupation of Warsaw, I believe, or maybe it was Krakow. But it was film footage from World War II. Of the Nazi occupation of some part of Poland, and it got an R rating and failed during its appeal as well.
Again, though, with a documentary about Nazis, kids under 18 don't care. If they were doing a documentary about how, you know, kids, you know, having sex via IM, that's a documentary a 15-year-old.
Right.
Wait a second, I'm just making a note. You know, I was actually in the airport. Not that this has anything to do with what we were just talking about, but I was in the airport over the weekend, and I guess there's a book now called Blank My Dad Says, and that blank is really a bleep for the S word. And there were five copies on the shelf, and there was a ton of empty shelf space next to it. And I picked up a copy and thumbed through it and then walked away and came back less than 5 minutes later. The other five copies were gone. Well, I'm sure whether people get to see the Pat Tillman documentary in the theater or on television, they're definitely going to be able to see it on Netflix, and they'll probably be able to stream it, depending on who's releasing it.
Did the Weinsteins have a deal with Netflix?
I have no idea, but Michael, why don't you tell us what went on here?
Well, Netflix struck a big deal over the weekend with a company called Epix that has the rights to a lot of movies. They struck a 5-year deal to gain streaming access to all of the Epix movies starting September 1st, this September, and it's a $900 million deal. It's almost $1 billion to get access to these movies, which include movies from Paramount Pictures, Lionsgate, and MGM, added to their already pretty big library of movies that they make available for you to stream immediately. And basically how the head of Netflix characterized it, he said, they're taking the big pile of money that they pay on postage to mail DVDs back and forth, which is about $600 million a year, and they're paying it to the studios and the networks to get rights to movies via streaming so they can, you know, instead of paying money on shipping, they'll just buy the rights to streaming and let you stream the movies into your home.
Yeah, I mean, Richard Greenfield over at BTIG Research, which is a great blog, by the way, if you get a chance to check it out, he has 12 takeaways from the Netflix Epix agreement. And the first being that, you know, this Epix channel was kind of a joke. It was the laughingstock of the cable industry because Paramount Pictures, Lionsgate, and MGM decided they were going to take their movies away from Showtime and end their output deal with Showtime, and they were going to go it alone. They were going to team up and create their own channel and release their movies through their own channel, and it just did not seem to be working out. They did not have the distribution they had hoped for. But now, with this deal, it will actually make them profitable.
Yeah, but, you know, it still doesn't change the fact that this is not going to affect Warner Brothers, 20th Century Fox, and Universal movies, which still have an output deal with HBO and HBO Go, their online service.
Right, but now HBO has a competitor, so that's good for everybody.
Oh, no, I think that's great. And I'm really excited that I'm going to be able to see Hot Tub Time Machine be streaming on Netflix.
You know, HBO said there is no way on God's green earth they are going to cut a deal with Netflix, at least now.
For their TV shows and their original content.
Right. And, right. You know, what the deal shows, as Richard Greenfield points out, is that digital content is valuable and that the digital distribution has legs. And Netflix is paying, I think, what is it, $1 per subscriber rather than what Showtime was willing to pay, which was, I think, 15 cents.
Well, I'm still confused, though, because most people who are going to be watching this streaming are probably watching this, I assume, on their laptops, right?
No, they can watch it through TiVo or a Roku box or the popcorn box.
Yeah, if they have access, if their television is connected in some way to the internet.
Like my Blu-ray player and my Sony PS3?
Right, correct. Mm-hmm. And it shows that Netflix, which is and started out as a DVD by mail rental service, is accelerating this shift to digital distribution.
Well, and they're realizing that it doesn't matter how people watch. They want to make it easier for people to watch movies. And they don't care whether they ship you the DVD or stream it to you. You know, they want to be the service you go to. They're not getting caught up in the idea, oh, we ship DVDs. You know, they're saying, no, streaming is fine. Whatever way we want to make it available, if that's what people want, we'll do it.
Now, there are two downsides to this deal. One, much like the deal that Netflix cut with Starz, this is a deal for standard def streaming. So there's no HD movies streaming through your TiVo or through your computer.
Now, why is that? Any idea? That seems so stupid.
That seems bizarre.
Well, I'm sure they're trying to create some kind of exclusivity to broadcast television, or not broadcast television, but
it just seems bad for everybody. Like, why want to show the movies in a, you know, I don't see the advantage of that for anyone. I don't see how that helps broadcast. Or I say, well, at least we're the ones who have it in height. It's like,
well, I'm sure that broadband wise, it helps out a little bit.
That's true. But still, it just seems like a bad, bizarre choice.
The other downside to this deal is the 90 day window that I guess the film was released on DVD. It's given to pay TV, and then 90 days after it's released on DVD and pay TV, it airs on, it's able to stream on Netflix. And I'm sure I screwed that up somehow, so please don't email me. I know that it's either DVD or pay TV. It's one or the other. It's not both. But somehow there's a 90-day delay here.
Just like video on demand is delayed from pay cable delay. There's just step by step, you know, things go on DVD, they become available on HBO, they become available on video on demand. Everybody's got their own little window, right?
Well, speaking of windows, I know we have a story on that in Big Deal or Big Whoop, so I won't touch on it now, but it is a very interesting deal that Netflix has cut with Epix, and it certainly makes them a big power player that makes them kind of equal to a big premium HBO or Showtime.
Now, have they overpaid? Because they certainly haven't eliminated their postage costs. They still have to, you know, even though it's a cute way to think about it, they still have to pay postage for people who want their movies via DVD. They're hoping to save money by having more people go to streaming. But since it's not high def and it's 3 months after it's available on DVD and pay-per-view or whatever the calendar may be, have they overpaid at all?
Only time can tell. I think that they paid probably the right amount because it's a five-year deal. Mm-hmm. So when you think that it's $200 some odd million per year, it's probably right there in the ballpark.
Or more like $125 million a year.
I'll go with $125 million.
Yeah, right? I mean, or $100 million a year, 5 years. Well, no, I'm sorry. $900 million. I was thinking it was $600 million. $900 million over 5 years. Yeah, that's like 1.5, 1.7 million.
And you know, it's a gamble worth taking because we are all going to be watching movies and television on our computers.
Which brings us to Hulu.
Yes, indeed. You want to tell us what happened there?
Well, Hulu is preparing for an initial public offering, an IPO. They're hoping to raise a ton of money. They're valuing themselves at around $2 billion. $2 billion. And Hulu, of course, is owned by GE's, NBC Universal, and News Corp, and Disney. It's this, you know, it's this entity owned by all these huge conglomerates. And they're hoping to, you know, get a big capital infusion to keep them competing with all the other people. And, you know, they want to start charging for subscriptions, and they're just sort of starting to make a little money in revenue, and they're looking to, you know, stay ahead of the game. But it's kind of old school, really, because they haven't really shown a profit yet, and yet they're already going public.
Well, yeah, they made $100 million in revenue last year, and we should probably point out that it was the New York Times that broke this story, that they have been talking to investment bankers in New York, which is a sign that they are thinking about moving towards an IPO. Hulu, as you said, Michael, owned by NBC, ABC, and Fox, and their parent companies, of course. But they also leave out two big players, CBS and the CW. They don't have programming from those two.
I wouldn't say the CW was a big player.
Well, I knew you were going to say that.
They are online.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, there you go. That's true. But The reaction has been a little cool to this, isn't it?
Well,
people aren't that excited by this IPO.
Well, because there are several other big IPOs in the makings. I know GM is thinking of an IPO later this year, as is Toys R Us. But really, there's no news on the $9.99 subscription plan in terms of how many people have signed up. It only made $100 million in revenue last year. They're valuing themselves at $2 billion. That's a big multiplier.
And they've got a lot of question marks about their future.
That's what I was going to say. I don't think they've established really their business model yet, or if they, you know, maybe they have and just haven't shared it with anybody other than venture capitalists.
Well, and you know, it should be said that if Hulu does have an IPO, what it would do is help them negotiate some of their content distribution deals. Because right now, you have NBC, ABC, and Fox saying, oh, you can air certain episodes but not others, or you can air only the last four episodes. And in an IPO situation, you take the company public, and Hulu would have to do whatever it takes to increase the value of the company for shareholders, whether it benefits NBC or Fox or not.
Right.
So it could put them in a situation where they are somewhat combative with their parent companies. It would also help them get out from underneath their parent companies, because their parent companies, while shareholders, may not be the majority shareholders.
And that's really interesting.
And they're freaked out by what Hulu does. They're not sure. So that may be one reason why Hulu isn't profitable.
Well, really, all this news has to do with receiving digital content, either streaming or via download. And that's what we're going to be discussing in our music news this week with Todd Martins, a reporter from the Los Angeles Times, who we talked to on episode 50 when we discussed Coachella. And Todd's work can often be found on a great blog that you should check out, Pop and Hiss. It's part of the LA Times blog network. Todd, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, last week I said that I would put money down on Arcade Fire's new album, The Suburbs, being the number one album of the week. And sure enough, it sold 156,000 copies in its first week, beating out its last debut for Neon Bible, I guess sold 97,000 copies in 2005. But there was a little interesting footnote in the 156,000, wasn't there?
Well, yeah, I mean, a significant portion, of more than half, it's like 68%. Were from the digital download sector. And I mean, that's so far in the span of 2 weeks, for instance, that album has sold 209,000 copies, according to SoundScan figures, and 122,000 of those were digital downloads. So, you know, it's a pretty significant number just from the digital sector. And I mean, there was a lot of talk online because, you know, Amazon put the record on sale for $3.99 for a week. And, you know, they do promotions like that for a lot of major releases, but usually they don't last a full week. So there was a lot of speculation that, you know, inspired or drove the sales.
Well, Well, Todd, I mean, do we have any idea how many, what percentage of sales went through Amazon?
Well, I mean, SoundScan doesn't break it out in right. terms of digital retailers. I mean, one thing that's sort of interesting to note is sort of, you know, I mean, iTunes is still, you know, the number one retailer in the world. So, I mean, it's a significant number that came from iTunes. And the Arcade Fire were also doing a pretty interesting thing on their own site. They were selling the album for $7.99 as a digital download with sort of like a digital picture book that they had created. And I know there was a significant number of, pre-orders for that. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to get a specific breakdown. But, I mean, there's no doubt that the Amazon sales certainly spurred some sales, and as probably more than would have been without it. What's interesting in that is, you know, I mean, labels and distributors don't really have much of a say in the price that Amazon sets.
So what you're saying, just to kind of clarify, is that Arcade Fire or Merge Records, the label that released the Suburbs, they couldn't turn to Amazon and say, listen, we really don't want you selling this for $3.99. If Amazon wants to take the loss and sell the album at $3.99, they'll do that. And they did do that for an entire week, which usually they have, you know, a 24 or 48 hour window for those types of sales. They did it for an entire week.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely trying to boost their market share and definitely trying to compete with iTunes in that sector. I mean, yeah, it's pretty much like a unilateral move on the part of the retailer. Going way, way back and getting like technical into retail stuff. I mean, there was the MAP, M-A-P, the minimum advertised price litigation and rulings in the mid 90s, late 90s that said, you know, a record label could not set a price. So basically saying, hey, you know, Best Buy started, you know, discounting stuff pretty heavily. So they said, you know what, we'll give you this record, but you can't sell it for $7.99. And basically, the labels were told they don't have the power to do that.
And that was sort of what killed a lot of independent record stores. You had Best Buy and Circuit City trying to, they were selling albums at a loss just to get people to come into their store and hopefully buy a stereo or a refrigerator. And, you know, record stores just couldn't compete because they were paying more for that. That was their entire business, was music.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it really hurt the indie record stores. And I mean, it was all about using music as, you know,
a loss leader.
The people in the trap, yeah, the loss leader, and just sell all this other stuff. And I mean, and partly, you know, that's what Amazon is doing with the digital store, because, I mean, they on the digital front, they are competing against iTunes. So you get someone buy a $3.99 Arcade Fire record, maybe they click something else. And, you know, so, I mean, there is some of that going on in the digital sector.
You have a quote here from the head of Merge Records, Laura Balance, who says, quote, devaluing music is something that concerns me greatly, but it's hard to draw a hard line on it. At this point, people can download music for free if they really want to. If you're trying to get people to buy music, people who wouldn't otherwise, maybe that's the way to do it, just to make it so cheap that it tips the scale. And she said 5 years ago, music was getting cheap, and she was kind of hesitant and reluctant to lower the price. But she says people want to pay less, and I'm certainly for the. I mean, I bought their album for $7.99 on Amazon and got the CD in the mail, and it was quite nice to pay $7.99 for the album. Is that a trend?
Yeah, I mean, I think the prices are going lower and lower. I mean, it's and part of that has been driven by, you know, the big box retailers like Best Buy and Walmart, and definitely in the digital sector. When I think the first time Amazon sort of generated the headlines for this kind of thing was a few years ago when Coldplay put out their new record. They were selling Coldplay's catalog for like 99 cents per album. And I think that's when they started to sort of get some headlines. And it's sort of, I mean, once you start doing that, that puts in the mind of the consumer, it's like, well, how much am I paying for this? Why is this more here? Why is this less here? And, you know, why does iTunes stick to this $9.99 price point? So, I mean, yeah, I mean, it definitely starts to push the music lower, and it starts to come up, you know, force labels to an artist to either come up with, you know, extra content for the record or use the record as a loss leader themselves as a way to get people in the door for concerts or as a way to sell merch or, you know, other items like that.
Well, now, speaking of concerts and merchandise, and this is kind of a little aside, but I ran across a story about tickets to Ozfest, which I guess is put on by Ozzy Osbourne. They're $10. The kicker is that the beer inside Ozfest is $13. So I guess the idea there being they attract everybody with the $10 ticket and fill the stadium. but then they overcharge them for all the merchandise and the beverages inside. Is that a trend you see continuing?
Yeah, I guess it's probably not even a good beer. It's probably like a little light or something. But yeah, I mean, Live Nation has been doing these sales for the last few months with people not going to concerts. I mean, I think the Ozfest ticket started at, you know, it's different markets, but it was at least $50 and $80 a seat or a ticket. And so they've been putting these things, these like fire sales, they'll be like $10 for 24 hours. And, you know, you get people to spend the $10. And the goal is, I mean, for Live Nation, they're making their money based on people in the venues and people buying beer, hot dogs, and all that stuff. So in their interest, it's in their interest to put the ticket as low as you can and get people in the venue. And, I mean, I think that's, you know, I mean, that's going to be a problem. I mean, it's the music industry and with people, less people going to concerts, ticket sales down. I think Polestar said something that the live industry was down about 17% from last year. So, you know, how much are people willing to pay and what do you got to do to get people in the door? I mean, that being said, if you have a hot act like Arcade Fire, Lady Gaga, people will still pay. But
I think 3 years ago, if you had said that Lady Gaga and Arcade Fire could maintain their ticket price and that the Jonas Brothers couldn't, I think that would shock a lot of people.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, just here in L.A. and the Irvine show, the Jonas Brothers are like $10, yeah.
But I mean, that is the silver lining of this. At least Arcade Fire is a great band that's been touring and building its audience in an organic, old-fashioned way. And if this takes them to another level, it's all for the good in a way.
And I have to say, I know you mentioned it earlier, this digital picture book. I ordered the album, got the CD, had no idea about the digital picture book, and apparently Merge Records said that Arcade Fire just kind of wanted to do it under the radar. I would have actually, for $3.99, I would have bought the digital album too for the picture book, and I would have had both a CD and a picture book. I don't know why they didn't promote that at all.
Well, the picture book didn't come with the Amazon $3.99 download. You only got that if you bought it direct from the band or direct from the label. So it was as a way to hopefully drive sales direct, and then they get a bigger chunk of it. But you know, I mean, the Arcade Fire, I mean, part of their success is kind of based on a little bit of mystery. You know, they don't tour all that often. They don't, you know, they don't license their music to, you know, TV shows and movies.
Well, let's talk about that direct licensing model here, because we also have a story that Universal Music Group is pulling videos from MTV's websites. And I guess the way MTV had previously licensed music videos, they licensed them directly from the record labels for use on MTV and MTV.com, VH1.com, and the Country Music Channel and CMT.com. But now Universal, Sony, and EMI and a couple of other labels want websites to let Vevo, this new kind of music video online channel that is a co-venture with YouTube, they want Vevo to syndicate its videos to all of these other sites, and Vevo will take control of the advertising and just give MTV.com and the MTV family of networks, they'll give them a cut of the ad revenue, but it is a lot less than they would make going, MTV would make going directly to the labels. Can you explain why the labels are doing this to MTV?
Well, I mean, the basic thought process is, you know, I mean, for years, people talked about, you know, digital downloads and promotion on like YouTube and stuff like that is, you know, just a way to like help create awareness or help sell records. And as record sales, CD sales continued to decline, I mean, the labels started to question, you know, why are we, you know, just giving this content away? And because this is where, you know, people are listening to stuff, you know, this is where people are finding about this music, and we own the content and we're just giving it away for next to nothing. Or a split in some sort of ad revenue. So they were, in the case of Universal and Sony, you know, they created Vevo to sort of get a chunk of that market and worked with YouTube so fans could still find it. But it's basically just an attempt by the majors to start finding a way to actually control the content and house the content rather than just having, you know, other sites, you know, reap the benefits of their content.
Right, and so they're kind of vertically integrating. They're becoming not only producers of the content, but they're distributing the content as well. I guess they've always distributed the content when you think about it, but I mean they're going almost direct to consumer.
It is part of the thought process of what are they going to do as CD sales continue to decline, and you know, the record label almost starts to look, you know, maybe more like a marketing firm or something. You know, with you know, putting music out there and making money off videos and making money off licensing and doing all sorts of other random facets. I mean, it sort of turns like the record label into like, you know, the act manager in a way.
I guess the next step would be for record labels to give music to radio stations, but include ads at the beginning and end of the song. Why give it away to radio stations and let them make all the advertising revenue?
Well, I mean, I think the United States is pretty much the only place where radio is not paying royalties on the music. So, I mean, that's something that the music industry is trying to change. I know online stations do have to, you know, Pandora. So, I mean, that's something that they're trying to change and trying to change through Congress, but it's going to be a long process.
Well, certainly it's a complicated subject, licensing, that is, as we have a little chart that we dug up that was published over the last week from Digital Music News, the rat's nest of music licensing. And rather than discuss it here, we'll post it in the show notes because it has so many arrows going to so many different entities and who pays what to whom and how they get rights to the music. It's impossible to follow. But Todd Martins from the Los Angeles Times, thank you very much for joining us to talk a little bit about digital music downloading.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. And it was, hopefully it wasn't too technical or businessy.
Oh, not at all. And your Twitter account, I believe, is Todd Martins.
Yeah, Twitter at Todd Martins. And I tweet random stuff. it's not necessarily approved by the work.
And of course, your writing can always be found on the Pop and Hiss blog. And again, I encourage everyone to check that out. It's a great music blog. Todd, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. Well, it was good of Todd to take the time to talk with us. His blog is really great, and it's good that all his attention is built around an album that's actually really good. It's definitely going to be one of the best albums of the year, the Arcade Fire Suburbs. You know, definitely one people want to listen to, whether you pay $3.99 or $7.99 or get a digital download or a CD. You know, it really matters because the music is really good.
Well, speaking of things that are really good, AMC's programming, the American Movie Channel, that's where Mad Men airs, that's where... I believe Breaking Bad airs there.
Yep.
And
yep.
Burn Notice?
No, Burn Notice is on USA.
You see, that's why I have them all recorded and not watched. I should probably watch them.
By the way, I think it's actually American Movie Classics.
Yes.
Okay, I'll go with American Movie Classics. I can't get anything right today. I don't know why. Well, they are picking up a new drama that the first episode, the pilot, is called The Killing. And it is a crime drama based on a popular Danish television series, For Bridelsen is the
For
name.
For Bridelsen.
Yes.
Oh.
Very good. The American version is going to be produced by Fox Television, and it's going to start airing in 2011. It follows the investigation of a murdered young girl. And I have to say, there was a lot of talk about, oh, will it be good or not, on Twitter last week. Frankly, I'm willing to give them a shot.
I'm sort of wondering why we're talking about this. I mean, Melissa and Joey was on ABC Family last night. We're not talking about that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's important.
It was highly entertaining.
Well, then maybe really the better segue would have been to NBC is ending Persons Unknown in a very strange way. Rather than broadcast.
What's Persons Unknown?
It's apparently a television series that nobody's watching, so much so.
It came on about 2 months ago. It's the one with Jason Wiles in it. I never saw it, but I think it's like 8 people after the apocalypse or something.
Really?
Well, if you want to watch it, you can do so online because both the 11th and 12th episodes will air, I guess, online only.
That's a good idea.
I apologize. The 11th episode will never air at all.
They're skipping the second to last episode and showing it online only. So they're ending the run a week early and they say, well, we got to have the final episode. So we'll throw the 11th episode up online.
Well, I don't know whether that's a big deal or not, but it seems like it's a strange way to end the season.
And that seems like a segue.
It is. In fact, it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week.
Ding, 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 ding.
And whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. First up, George Lucas announced this week that the classic film Star Wars will not be coming to Blu-ray. Of course, what he did say was that the special editions of the original trilogy and the 3 prequels will be coming to Blu-ray in a box set around November 2011, just in time for Christmas. But the original theatrical editions? It's too expensive for him to bother. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Too expensive for him to bother?
Well, I think it's just another way of him saying, That way I get to sell them to you again.
Yeah.
No, no, it's not, because he hasn't put out the Star Wars on DVD yet. You can only get them in a crappy unremastered add-on to one of the special editions. He's a total putz. He's just such a jerk. He's so annoyed that people want the original versions of the movies, and he treats all the fans so dismissively. It really is just infuriating. And the special editions, of course, contain 98% of the original movie. So to say it's too expensive to do that last little bit just to release the original theatrical versions is so obnoxious. Just admit you hate the fact that people like them better, and you don't want to admit you're wrong. It's a big deal that he's such a
putz. So what you're saying, Michael, is that that's a big deal, right? Because I was going with Big Whoop.
Well, there you go. I think it's a big deal that he's such a putz.
I won't disagree with that.
Okay, are you ready for this next one?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, I know you're both waiting.
I'm really excited.
The show notes actually have musical notation here. You're really not going to make me sing this, are you?
Spider-Man does whatever a spider can.
Comes to Broadway in the fall when we thought it wouldn't happen at all. Look out, here comes the Spider-Man. That's right, Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark begins previews on November 14th and opens December 21st with Bono and the Edge doing the songs and Julie Taymor doing the directing. Of course, nobody even thought this thing would hit Broadway. It was so expensive and so technically difficult. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. I really thought it was going to fall apart, and they've brought it all together. It's going to be the most expensive musical in Broadway history. I can't wait to see it.
I agree. It's a big deal for Broadway. And I know where you're going to be November 14th, Michael.
Oh, yeah.
Arnold Schwarzenegger threatened, "I'll be back," in the very first Terminator movie, and that franchise has kept its promise. The Mechanical Man from the future has appeared in 4 feature films, a TV series, comic books, video games, and presumably a pinball machine in there somewhere. Now, it's coming back to the movies as Terminator 3000, a $70 million 3D animated film. No word yet on whether Governor Schwarzenegger will be lending his vocal talent. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
No!
Never mind. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop until we see the product, but I like the fact that animated movies are expanding beyond the standard Disney Pixar thing, and they should be doing sci-fi and all sorts of strange things, so I'm glad.
Thank you, Sandra Bullock. Actor Ryan Reynolds had the biggest hit of his career in a starring role when he made The Proposal with Bullock. Now Reynolds is in the midst of a tug of war over not one, but 2 comic book franchises. Warner Brothers has Reynolds playing the Green Lantern in a franchise that launches next summer, and for which they're already working on the sequel. So Warner's is none too pleased that Reynolds might also play the superhero Deadpool in a spinoff of the X-Men Wolverine. He had a supporting role in that film. Karen, is this tussle over Reynolds a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a pretty big deal for his career. What I find really strange is that why is this becoming a tussle now? It was decided he was going to play Deadpool in a movie spinoff, what, a year ago?
Michael?
Yeah, I think it's a big deal with 2 studios trying to butt heads and trying to force him to choose between these franchises. I can understand him not wanting to be in both, you know? It's sort of a little confusing.
Justin Bieber is making a totally awesome concert film / biopic. But his first choice for director, Oscar winner Davis Guggenheim, of An Inconvenient Truth, had to bow out, probably when he found out Justin Bieber was starring in the film. But now,
stop saying that.
But now someone else has stepped up to the plate, and the winner is John Chu, the director of both Step Up 2, The Streets, and Step Up 3D. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal because it makes a lot more sense for him to direct it than Davis Guggenheim.
Karen.
Yeah, I totally agree. Actually, it's so appropriate, it almost becomes a big whoop.
George Michael stoned. Again. Facing charges. Again. He crashed his car into a building and wham! Michael is back in the headlines. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I hadn't even heard about it, so I'm going to say a big whoop.
Michael?
It's a big whoop, but it's sad. I mean, he literally, repeatedly is in his car stoned and incapable of driving.
Well, maybe somebody should wake him up before he goes.
Oh,
funny. I think that the Mel Gibson getting in a car crash was actually much more compelling.
What happened? What happened?
Oh, he had a car accident in Malibu.
Oh.
Yeah, he was supposedly weaving all over the road. I really haven't paid that much attention to it, but he was weaving all over the road, and yet alcohol is not suspected, so maybe he was stoned. I don't know.
So You Think You Can Dance didn't quite recover from its fall debacle in the ratings. But the summer series still pulls in young viewers, and they crowned Lauren America's favorite dancer over runner-up Kent. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. Poor Kent. My streak of picking the losers remains unbroken. It's unbelievable. If I'm rooting for you, give up.
Yeah, this is a huge, huge deal because I called Lauren a while back.
She had the best finale. She was great. And you know, it was a really good finale. There was a lot of great dance pieces in that show.
If you're going to greenlight a TV show, you have two hot options. Give a series a 12-episode order, the way a lot of cable channels do, or give it a 100-episode order and save money all around. That's what TBS did with two Tyler Perry sitcoms, and now they're doing it with Ice Cube's sitcom, Are We There Yet? Starring, of course, Terry Crews of Everybody Hates Chris. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's a fascinating trend in TV to sort of just book the whole show all at once just so everybody can save money and, you know, plan long term. It's interesting.
Karen?
Yeah, I agree. It's a big deal. It's for the same reason. It's fascinating.
After one of the most talked about casting searches since Scarlett O'Hara said fiddle-a-dee, the English language version of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo has found its female lead, and her name is not Natalie Portman. In fact, not Scarlett Johansson. But Rooney Mara. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is such a big deal that I wish that we'd moved it up and talked about it in the movie section. At first, I wasn't a huge fan of the choice. She wasn't that good in the Nightmare on Elm Street remake, and she was awful in this episode of Women's Murder Club that I saw. But huh. I've been watching interviews with her, and she's actually quite charming. I think she could make a good Lisbeth. This is a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal. I agree. I mean, it's a big deal for her career, no doubt about it. And it's
huge.
The right choice not to go with a big name, I think.
Are you ready to get your freak on? Well, you won't have to wait until October 1st. The documentary film Freakonomics, based on the columns and best-selling books by Stephen Levitt and Michael's former boss, Stephen Dubner, is coming to theaters October 1st, but it premieres first on iTunes a month earlier on September 3rd. It's the latest in a wave of movies, invariably indie films and documentaries, that become available via video, on demand, or streaming, or in other ways, either the same day they're released in theaters or even earlier. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It just seems what a lot of small movies are doing these days.
Karen?
I think it's a big deal for the same reason, actually.
Dr. Laura Schlesinger is quitting radio. The controversial talk show host and best-selling author, known for her bigoted comments about gays and others, got into more hot water recently when she used the N-word to discuss racism with a black female caller. Schlesinger was talking about how black people can use the N-word, and it's affectionate, but if a white person does it, it's seen as derogatory. Schlesinger announced on Larry King Live she's quitting her show when her contract runs out at the end of the year. Her radio show is currently tied for third with Glenn Beck and Michael Savage and reaches about 8 million listeners. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal because even though she's off the cultural radar a bit, she's still a big force in radio right alongside her fellow bigots, Glenn Beck and Michael Savage.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I'm not sure that in the context, in this particular example you just gave, that it shows that she's a bigot, but she is very, very conservative. I'm not a fan.
CNN crushes Fox News in the ratings. Online ratings, that is. CNN often ranks third in the ratings for news channels on cable, way behind Fox News and even behind MSNBC. But in one area, CNN ranks first, online. The Fox News website lags way behind CNN and Yahoo and MSNBC. CNN.com consistently beats Fox Online by 7 or 8 million unique visitors. It also beats Fox News in every measure, like page views, time spent, and video streams. And it has an early lead in mobile as well, 14 million users versus 9 million. And I would assume these numbers are per month. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is a big deal. It says so much about the age of Fox News fans, doesn't it?
It most certainly does.
It does. It's a big deal. And I think it's also that Fox News is not a source for news. It's an entertainment channel where people go to hear people laugh. Why would they turn to them for news? You know, that's
not what they do. A lot of people go online to watch comedy.
You know what? Without Fox News, Jon Stewart would have absolutely no material.
That's true.
Speaking of online, TorrentReactor.net has bought itself a village. The website, popular for people looking to illegally download new movies and TV shows, spent $150,000 and counting to get the godforsaken, quote-unquote, Russian village of Gar to rename itself to TorrentReactor.net. The town is near a nuclear reactor and has virtually no local businesses. The money is being split among residents and also used to repair roads and make other improvements. TorrentReactor.net also decided to provide them with broadband access. Previously, the town of 214 people, whose average income is $42 per year, only had three computers and one dial-up service. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop.
Karen?
Oh, I think this is a big deal. I think it's, first of all, it's hilarious. And it's just so wonderfully random. But it also makes me think, what town was ever renamed Google? Do you guys know?
There are several of them that have renamed.
But that was just a short-term stunt. This is permanent.
Yeah, that's what makes it, I think, so wonderfully wonderful. It's so random.
Well, what I didn't like was how Torrent tried to make it sound like this is their wave of charity for this. They called it this godforsaken town, which it basically is, but that's kind of tacky to say. And they make it sound like it's their charitable work as opposed to publicity for themselves.
They did help these people, though. I mean, you can certainly argue that. I mean, was it tacky of them to call it the town godforsaken? Well, sure, but hell, who cares? Look at all the free stuff they got.
Well, finally, American Idol winner and R&B superstar Fantasia Barrino was hospitalized on August 10th for exhaustion and overdosing on aspirin and a sleeping pill. I guess just one sleeping pill, not more than one. Or as most newspapers called it, a suicide attempt after her affair with a married man broke into the news. 1 week later, she's back in the saddle promoting her new album, appearing on talk shows and doing the wildly exhausting sprint through the media that album launches entail for a big star. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I'm going to turn this over to Michael because I know, Michael, you've got strong feelings on this.
Well, I thought it was a big deal, kind of upsetting. I mean, she possibly attempted suicide and immediately it's like, well, let's get back to work. You know, the whole grind that stars sometimes go through, I found it kind of upsetting that they would just shove her right back out there again. That can't be the best thing for her.
Okay, yeah, that was my reaction too. I wanted you to speak to it first. I find this, first of all, just even the way that we intro'd this is actually rather upsetting. Was your point. No, it was your point. People are like, oh yeah, exhaustion. Took, you know, a few too many sleeping pills, but it was a suicide attempt or an alleged suicide attempt. I just find it very upsetting. She's probably too naive to
say no,
know how to say no, and that she will just get right back up and start pushing her album. Maybe she wanted to. I mean, she has to make money, but.
But if your manager wants to help you, maybe the best thing is to, you know what? We can put things on hold for a little bit.
Yeah. Do you know how many managers, though, actually think along those lines? It's unfortunate.
Yeah, I hope she'll be all right. I find it upsetting.
That brings us to our final segment, Inside Baseball, where we discuss only the news stories that people in Hollywood might care about. This week, we'll touch on MGM just for a second here. As everybody on the planet seems to know now, MGM is in debt, serious debt. They owe $4 billion to a whole bunch of VC and private equity people. And those folks, they want the money back. They don't want to keep lending money to MGM. That's put all of these films like the next James Bond filmed and The Hobbit in this weird kind of hiatus or purgatory. Nobody knows how they're going to finance their new films. But in walks Gary Barber and Roger Birnbaum of Spyglass, who seems to be close to making a deal for the film, The company will be valued at $1.9 billion. Who knows how they're going to get money, though, to finance any of their films. So we'll keep an eye on what's going on with MGM and whether Spyglass is able to cut a deal. What's more interesting is this new angel. We kind of talked a little bit about it at the head of the show. David Ellison, the son of Larry Ellison. And if Larry Ellison's name sounds familiar, that's because he's a multi-billionaire and the founder CEO of Oracle, one of the largest technology companies in the world. But David Ellison is his 27-year-old son who was welcomed with open arms as he showed up at Paramount's door with $350 million to co-fund movies. And the first three movies he's going to be co-funding will be Mission Impossible 4, and what else? There's a
True Grit and Jack Ryan, the latest Jack Ryan thriller.
Well, it turns out David Ellison is showing up with deep pockets. He will be helping defray the costs of Paramount films with budgets over $30 million. So any film that has a budget over $30 million, they'll go to David Ellison and see if he wants to participate. This is not unlike what occurred in the mid-2000s when hedge funds were helping defray some of the costs and banks as well. In fact, Paramount, up until 2008, had a deal with Deutsche Bank to help defray some of their costs, Deutsche Bank took an equity stake in some of the films and would then, you know, Paramount wouldn't have to take all the risk in releasing a film. They stopped doing that when credit became tight in 2008. They've been going it alone ever since. So here comes David Ellison with
Larry Ellison.
No, David Ellison.
Oh, no, it's David Ellison. I'm sorry. Yeah.
David Ellison with $350 million. Now, it's $150 million in equity and over 4 years and a $200 million revolving credit facility led by JPMorgan Chase.
Well, blah, blah, blah. The main thing is that this guy is a sucker. Because unless you're building a library, there's no point to be offering people money for a piece of a movie. I mean, it's just a bad game to play. You never come off. People come into Hollywood in the 70s, the 80s, and 90s. They come from real estate or grocery stores or whatever. They got a lot of money. They want to make movies. And they always end up getting suckered and going home with a barrel instead of their clothes.
Yeah, they buy into the glamour and they think they're going to be going to lots of parties and, you know, getting laid and such. And they probably are, but...
Well, why? What about Ryan Kavanaugh of Relativity? I mean, that is the same type of model. You know, he's paying portions of budgets over at Universal and Rogue.
All I know is when outsiders show up in Hollywood with lots of money and want to fund parts of movies, then, you know, the real money to be made in Hollywood is by building a library. And you can go movie to movie and you can sometimes make money. But long term, unless you're building a library and getting some stake long term, you're not really doing a smart thing.
Yeah, I wonder what the long term equity stake in these films is going to be.
And people are never going to stop being fascinated by Hollywood and wanting to have some kind of a stake in it.
And thank goodness for that, because if they did stop being fascinated by Hollywood, they might not listen to our podcast. Which can be found on showbizsandbox.com, our website, but also on iTunes and the Zune Marketplace and several other podcast aggregators. If you want links to any of the stories we talked about in today's episode, you can find them in the show notes for episode 67 on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That is also where you will find links to all of our social networking accounts, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn, as well as ways to contact us. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND or 888-567-7263. And the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Karen Woodward can be found usually in front of her computer doing some type of social networking.
Always in front of my computer.
But also on KarenWoodwardOnline.com or on her Twitter account @Karen_Woodward. Michael Giltz can be found all over writing for so many outlets that he has to have a website just to compile everything and show it to the world. MichaelGiltz.com is the website to look up for all of Michael's writing, or you can follow him on Twitter @MichaelGiltz. Is the username to look up. I'm on Twitter @Sperling is my username. You can find some of my writing on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.